Welcome to the Dialogues Podcast, brought to you by the Center for Asian American Christianity at Princeton Theological Seminary. This podcast features the voices of Asian American scholars, ministry leaders, and activists in an ongoing dialogue about theology and ministry. We provide Asian American ministry leaders with a forum for dialogue, support, and critical reflection on ministry by Asian Americans, especially in Asian American ecclesial contexts.
This is our first event in our Dialogues in Asian American Theology and Ministry series. Welcome. My name is Dr. David Chow. It's my pleasure to be your host tonight, and I will introduce our presenter. But first, a brief description of what this series of events is. The Dialogues in Asian American Theology and Ministry provides Asian American ministry leaders with a forum for dialogue, support, and critical reflection on ministry by Asian Americans, especially in Asian American ecclesial contexts. And I just want to make sure with my team, is the audio coming through? Yes. All right, great, wonderful. You know, there's a little bit of technical rust with the first event that we're kicking off this academic year, but I think we have everything working. So it is my pleasure to introduce our presenter tonight. Reverend Dr. Eunju Kim was born in Seoul, South Korea, and came to the States in 1974. She graduated from Cornell University with a double major in American history and music theory, and then went on to Princeton Theological Seminary. It's fantastic to see some alum in the room, where she received her MDiv in 1993 and her THM in 1996. Over the years, Eunju has served as youth pastor, English ministry pastor, and speaker at several Korean American churches in the tri-state area and gatherings across the country. Reverend Kim is a board-certified chaplain and was staff chaplain at New York Hospital, Queens for 10 years. She served as the spiritual advisor for the National Korean Presbyterian Women, NKPW, of the PCUSA from 2017 to 21, and worked as the program coordinator of Rise Together, a national mentorship network for women of color in ministry. Reverend Kim finished her doctorate in church leadership at Fordham and most recently completed a two-year term as the interim EM pastor of the Arumdaum Church in Bethpage, Long Island. Reverend Kim is interested in the intersection of culture, community, and the church, and is a big fan of K-pop and K-dramas. We're in for a treat tonight. Let's welcome Reverend Dr. Eunju Kim.
Thank you very much for having me on this muggy night in Princeton, New Jersey. I would like to, first of all, thank Dr. David Chow, the Center for Asian American Christianity and Princeton Theological Seminary, for their invitation and hosting tonight's event. I have been a longtime fan of the center and their programming, especially as they have focused on race, mental health, discipleship, vocational formation, that is, and leadership. So I can't believe that I have this platform tonight to talk about one of my passions with folks here in person, here in Princeton, and online, watching from across the country. And this gave me an opportunity to reach back to my former youth folks from Hansung Presbyterian Church, KCPCQ, as well as Yale Presbyterian Church. I think some friends and colleagues from CAPCW, Clergywoman Gathering of the PCSA, Korean American Women, Cohen, NKPW, NCKPC, EM Pastors, as well as the Queens YWCA. So I want to acknowledge all the people that have been a part of my community over the years. And if anybody's to blame for what I'm going to give you tonight, it's all of them. So I would like to acknowledge them and thank them as well. I also want to take time to especially thank my sister, Dr. Haeju Kim, who actually wrote her PhD thesis in ethnomusicology entitled Hearing the Korean Global, Hallyu in the Music of K-Dramas. So she studied the music in Korean dramas, and she actually was one of the first people who taught Korean music more than a decade ago in Wesleyan, entitled From Gugak to K-Pop. And so I want to thank her because she allowed me to watch a lot of K-dramas. She was studying it and suffering through it, and she had to think a lot and analyze and think about the theories, and I was just enjoying it. And I told people, no, I'm not having fun. I'm just helping my sister in her thesis, so I would like to thank her. I would also like to thank one of my former students, Esther Park, and her cousin, Eunice Kim, who have been my K-pop educators and suppliers, as well as my discussion partners over the years in K-pop. I stand here tonight to say that I'm not an expert in K-pop, but I am an enthused fan. I leave all the heavy theory and thinking to people like, and I read this in the Princeton the website, folks like Dr. Casey Choi, who actually has a course this semester called K-pop Activism, Asian and Asian American Theologies and Democracy. And I leave it to folks who have swam in theories like Dr. Ann Jo in Garrett Theological Seminary, who actually shared with me that she is an ARMY, a fan of BTS. And she has talked about BTS in her doctoral seminar entitled Decolonizing the Human. And I just recently found that there is a PhD person in ILIF, Eunjin, who is working on body image through K-pop. So there are a lot of people doing really heavy duty work. I'm just here benefiting from their hard work and enjoying what I have been doing, that is being a very enthusiastic fan. Now, I guess I should start off by setting my context. I came to the United States in 1974. And if you know the history of Korean American immigration, I was part of the post-1965 Immigration Act immigrants. And so in Korean American immigration, there are three waves. The first wave took place in the beginning of the 1900s, where it was mostly men with a few women and children who went to Hawaii to work the sugarcane fields. And there are a lot of single men who went to work there. But later on, there were also a lot of picture brides who came because the men realized that they couldn't go back to an occupied country, which was colonized by Japan at that time. And so that's the first wave of the Korean-American wave of immigrants. The second wave took place around the time of the Korean War from 1950 to 1953 and beyond. And most of the people who came to the States were adoptees. There were a lot of war orphans and children who were left at the orphanage during the war. And so there were a lot of adoptees as well as military brides who came, as well as international students. And that's the second wave. I think the majority of the Korean Americans that you see here in this country came post-1965, the Immigration Act of 1965. And I came to the United States in 1974. So that sets me in context of my experience here as an immigrant and as a daughter of immigrants. And so at that time, if you can imagine, I grew up in Buffalo for a few months and then came down to New York City, Queens. I live in Whitestone, which is not too far from Flushing, Queens, where there are a lot of Asian Americans. But when I was growing up in the 1970s, you were just happy to see another Asian face. And you went up to them just to be close to them. These days, we have a lot of Asians in Flushing, so there are a lot of people trying to get away from the Asian Americans. But at that time, we were very excited and happy to see each other. And if you grew up in the 70s, and probably in the 80s as well, there are a lot of questions that people asked you. I had this question asked of me often. So, are you Chinese? No. Are you Japanese? No. And then a lot of them would scratch their head and say, then what are you? Because Korea was not a part of the options or thoughts of the answer that these people had. And so I grew up in a time where there weren't that many Asian Americans, and I thirsted to see people who looked like me on television. Like many immigrant children, I was a latchkey kid, and so we went home, and part of my education of American culture was from popular culture, television. And I watched a lot of television. I knew what time and day it was by what show was playing on television. Tuesdays, 8 o'clock, ABC, Happy Days. And then following that, Laverne and Shirley, right? So there are a whole bunch of television shows that raised me and helped me to understand American culture and also where I learned English. But I was really thirsting to see people who look like me on television. as well as the media. And so we had to do with MASH, which was a show about the Korean War, but actually was really about the Vietnam War. I was very excited to see in the 70s, there was a group called Pink Ladies. I don't know if you remember, there were two Japanese women who were in a singing duo in the 1970s. So I was really happy to see them. We had a Korean-American comedian named Johnny Yoon, and he told a lot of jokes. He came out on Johnny Carson. And I was so happy to see Arnold in Happy Days, Mr. Arnold in Happy Days. And so I kept looking for them, but little did I know that actually there were quite a few Asian Americans in media in American history. Who here has heard of Anna May Wong? Anybody? Yes. She was in over 60 movies, and she was the first Chinese-American film star in Hollywood. She was born in LA. Her grandfather came to the United States in 1850s. How about Philip Ahn? Anybody? Korean-American actor, was in over 180 films and had TV credits that were close to 200 appearances. There was also, recently as we found out, James Hong, who was part of Everything Everywhere All at Once, and he has been a character actor in many different television shows as well as movies. Here's another person, Sesue Hayakawa. Anybody? Anybody? He was a Japanese-American silent film star, and he was one of Hollywood's first male sex symbols. He was a matinee idol. Now, why do we not know about these names? Because we do not get Asian American history in our American history classes. So I am standing here as a proponent and as somebody who is hoping that more classrooms will have a curriculum that will incorporate Asian Americans and Asian American history. Now, if I had Asian American history taught to me correctly, I would have known about these people. Some of you might have heard of them, called the Kim sisters. Now, I did what Yan Yan did. I crossed my fingers. I said a quick prayer. So hopefully the technology will work and you might be able to hear everything. But here they are, the Kim sisters. I don't know if you've ever heard about the Kim sisters, but they actually came to the United States in the late 1950s and 60s, and they appeared in one of the most famous television shows called The Ed Sullivan Show 22 times. And so I would have been so excited if I had known about this group when I was growing up here in the 70s as well as the 80s. So there was such a dearth of Asian Americans in media that I don't know if anybody has watched Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It came out in the year 2000. I have a confession. I watched it 13 times in the theater. I brought different people each time to make sure that they watched it because I knew that if they didn't make the box office tickets, that they would not make another Asian American film or films about Asian Americans. And so I could do a whole nother, talk about why I watched it 13 times. I bought like a few of the DVDs as well. But there was such a thirst for me to see somebody who looked like me on television and in the big screen. But once again, in the 70s, there were not that many. In the 80s, there were not that many. And so you could imagine my excitement when something like this happened in 2008.
Somebody there? I'm sorry, we're closed for the night. You're gonna have to come back tomorrow.
I don't think so.
Rain in a dance battle with Stephen Colbert when he was still on the Colbert Report. There was this animosity that Colbert had against Rain because Rain came out on top ahead of Colbert, who came in second in Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People in 2007. And then did the same thing again in 2008. And this was a joke because at that time, people didn't know who Rain was. People didn't know what K-pop was. And again, it was still in the fringes of mainstream American society. So you can imagine my surprise when this came out.
I'm the heat on the street, and I'm asking women one burning question. What's VMS? K-pop band?
Did you catch that? Well, one of the big surprises is, just FYI, this is your a public service announcement for today. VMS stands for vasomotor symptoms, and it's hot flashes and night sweats due to menopause. So what's surprising is that this commercial came out in the last Super Bowl. But so that's the first surprise. The second surprise is, you caught that. What is that? VMS? Is that a K-pop band? And so there was no explanation. It was just assumed that people will know what K-pop is. And so that was very surprising. And so since the fringes of the dance battle with Rain, with Colbert, to VMS, is that a K-pop band, something has happened. Something occurred. And that is what is known as Hallyu. Hallyu, some people spell it H-A-N-R-Y-U, others spell it H-A-L-L-Y-U, and literally is from Chinese, called the Korean Wave. And that was coined in the late 1990s when a K-pop band called H.O.T. Performed in Beijing. And so they were describing this. And so as Hallyu started to be coined and recognized and began to expand throughout the Asian countries and beyond, Korean music also started expanding as well. So in Korea, Korean popular music was called Gayo. They didn't have to call it Korean pop because it was in Korea. But as Korean music started gaining traction and popularity, it began to be called Korean pop or K-pop for short. And so Hallyu is the expansion of Korean cultural content, Korean culture, if you will, beyond the borders of the country called South Korea. There was this aha moment when folks realized that Jurassic Park, the movie, made more money than all the Hyundai cars that were sold at that particular year. And so they realized the power of exporting culture, and this became more of a thing that started to happen organically as well as deliberately. And so you'll see the growth of Hallyu over the years, not only in music, which I'll talk about a bit later, but in dramas, Korean dramas. Korean dramas have gotten really big over the years, but there was a time when there were seasonal dramas, Korean dramas called The Endless Love Series, Autumn in My Heart, 가을 동화, or Winter Sonata, 겨울 연가, or Summer Scent, 여름 향기, or Spring Waltz, 봄의 월승. And so these were depending on who you talk to, kind of sappy, romantic, emotional dramas that were really consumed voraciously by neighboring Asian countries. But these dramas started gaining more popularity in different parts of the world. And so some of the most famous dramas that people might or might not have heard of include 모래시계, Hourglass. That was the time where there were no taxis or cars. You couldn't catch a taxi in Korea because of the popularity of this drama. My name is Kim Sam-sun. 내 이름은 김삼순 was also very popular. I think it had up to like 45% of the viewership in Korea at that time. One of my favorites is 대장금, Jewel in the Palace. It's like a long series, 54 episodes, I think over an hour episode long, each of them. But I remember even my uncle watched it, and I remember asking my young cousin at that time, what's your dad doing? He's like, he said, he's watching some cooking show. So it's not only about cooking, but it's about a court cook who became a doctor to the king. And so 대장금 was one of my favorites. But as the years went by and with the growth of OTTs like Netflix, I think it's not uncommon for people to ask each other, what are you watching these days? And so if you have Netflix, I'm sure you have heard of Kingdom or Hospital Playlist or something that was really big was Squid Game, as well as The Glory. I think Disney Plus wants to get in on it. So one thing that was really popular recently was called Moving. And so Korean dramas have become very popular. I think the pandemic helped in promoting and spreading access to international content. So dramas became really big. But I'm sure there's some people here in the room and as well as online who remember going to the video stores and renting out boxes and boxes of VHS tapes to watch throughout the weekend or throughout the night. So dramas started to add to the growth of the Hallyu Korean wave. Then there were movies. A lot of the movies dealt with the division between South and North Korea, which is a very essential psyche of many Koreans even till today. And so we had movies like Joint Security Area as well as Shiri. Old Boy caught international attention in the Cannes Film Festival, as well as movies like Train to Busan. And then in year 2020, we had the Oscar-winning Parasite. Now, when I like something, I gotta make sure everybody else at least tries it or likes it. And so I remember when Parasite won the Oscar, you don't know how many texts and emails I got congratulating me. And I'm like, I didn't have anything to do with it. Maybe a little, and just making sure that everybody watched it at least once. And so, and then later on, we had a Korean-American film, Minari, that came out as well. So I think in the realm of dramas, we see the expansion of Korean content. In the realm of movies, we see also the growth and recognition of cinema. And also in the area of music, we see the beginning of appreciation and excitement for what Korea has been producing. Prior to the explosion of K-pop, we had mostly ballads and songs that your grandparents would listen to called trot. And they would usually have all these music shows that would showcase all these artists singing. And music, for those of us living in the United States, were through the VHS tapes that had about the Korean music shows or through, I don't know if folks still here remember cassette tapes. There are some of us who grew up with 8-track tapes, but that's how music was spreading and shared at that time. But we come to 1992, and this happened.
I'm not afraid to die.
see they're wearing suits and they're dancing. But this was very shocking for a lot of Koreans at that time who were used to ballets and trot. Here was 서태지와 아이들, or 서태지 and the boys, who were presenting hip-hop, rap, and rock for the first time. And so they had really low evaluations and reviews from these judges at these music competitions or shows. But they can be the milestone by which we could say pre-Seotaeji and the boys and post-Seotaeji and the boys. They debuted in 1992. And when I graduated seminary in 93, I went to Korea for about 9 months. You could hear this song everywhere. Subway, shops, restaurants. I work with youth group folks who were born in the United States. But it didn't matter. They still knew the lyrics. I still remember. 난 알아요. 이 밤이 흐르고 흐르고 누군가가 나를 떠나버려야 한다는 그 사실을 그 이유를 이제는 나도 알 수가 있어요. I'm not doing it in rhythm, but even folks, second-gen kids who were born here, they started memorizing the lyrics, and they started participating and wanting to know more about Korean music, Korean hip-hop. So what they did was to bring in hip-hop, and later on, Korean bands and groups started incorporating more R&B. And so I am a fan of 1990s music. I could fight anybody on this. Michael Jackson, we had all these other groups as well. And hip-hop, R&B has been really done well by K-pop groups, which I hope that you could hear and experience as we go on. So during this time, there were three major entertainment companies that started to grow, and later on it became four major entertainment companies. We had, first of all, in 1989, SM Studio. SM stands for Suman. Suman Lee was the person who started SM Studio. Later on in 1995, it became SM Entertainment, but SM stands for Suman. And so SM Entertainment had groups, and I don't know, again, how many K-pop folks are here, that had groups like H.O.T., SES, Shinhwa. They also had 소녀시대, or Girls' Generation, FX, SHINee, EXO, Red Velvet, NCT, aespa, and recently RIZE, R-I-I-Z-E. And now I hope to play one of their songs later on. And so we had SM Entertainment. There was another group called YG Entertainment, and that began in 1996. Now, remember 서태지 아이들? One of the 아이들 is a guy named Yang Hyun-seok. And so in Korean, they would call him Yang-gun. It's like Mr. Yang or a young man. And so he would take the Yang-gun and made it into YG. And that's why we have YG Entertainment. And YG Entertainment is famous for groups like Jinushan, One Time, Seven, Big Bang, 2NE1, Winner, Icon, Blackpink, which is one of the biggest girl groups right now. And I think they're working on a new group called Baby Monster. And so that's the second group. The third group is known as JYP, JYP Entertainment, standing for Jinyoung Park, Park Jinyoung. And that started in 1997 as Taehong Planning Corporation, which became JYP Entertainment in 2001. And in this group, we have groups like RAIN, G.O.D, Wonder Girls, 2AM, 2PM, Miss A, TWICE, Stray Kids, Day 6, ITZY, and they're now working on an international group. For now, I think it's called A2K, America to Korea, A2K. So there's this big audition show that is going on right now. And the fourth big group that we should all know about is HYBE, H-Y-B-E, formerly known as Big Hit Music. Big Hit Music started in 2005, and it turned into HYBE in 2021. But I love the tagline for Big Hit Music. And their tagline was, music and artist for healing. Music and artist for healing. And so what group came out of there? Of course, BTS, which I'll talk about later, but TXT, They also merged with other companies, and now they have 17 and Zico and Le Serafim and New Jeans, which is an affiliated group, or I guess production company, Adore, that has New Jeans. And so the four major entertainment companies that produce these K-pop stars and groups are SM, there's no quiz, don't worry about it, but SM Entertainment, YG Entertainment, JYP Entertainment, as well as HYBE. Now, again, when K-pop started getting traction, I really didn't believe it. I thought it was all hype. I thought people were lying and overhyping the interest that people had. But I remember going to a Rain concert, P, in 2006, Madison Square Garden Theater. So maybe a few thousand people, but I was blown away that the audience was not all Korean. So I was very impressed with that, but I still thought, no, it's in Korean it's called gukbong, like you're like making it sound better than it really is because of nationalism and patriotic pride. But I remember hearing that when SM Town or SM Entertainment had a concert in Paris, it sold out, I think, in a few hours. So they not demonstrated, but danced asking SM for another day. And so they added another day to their tour in Paris. And so I remember watching videotapes of this, and I remember seeing like hundreds of teenagers, mostly teenagers at that time, running into the arena so that they could finally see live in person SM Entertainment's groups. And so I remember thinking, oh, this could be real. There's no way that SM Entertainment could have paid each and every one of these hundreds of people to act like this. And so I had to see for myself, and SM Town came actually to Madison Square Garden Arena in 2011. And I went there with my sister, and they were in front of me, Chinese-Canadian college students who had flown in from Canada to watch this show. So I'm thinking, oh, this is actually real. And I went into the arena, and I still remember to this day, watching this tall, elderly white woman who came to this concert by herself. And she was wearing a blue t-shirt with capital letters, Super Junior, on it. And she came to the concert. And so I started thinking, wow, this is bigger than I thought. And so as I was contemplating, wow, this could be something really concrete, then this happened. So now you're going to have that song in your head for the rest of the night. This was 20 years later after Seotaeju Idol, 1992. This is year 2012. And I remember, again, getting excited. Why? Because I'm seeing somebody like me on television. And he's showing up in Good Morning America, speaking Korean. He's showing up in all these award shows. I started to listen to American radio stations again, just so that I could see if I could hear Gangnam Style. I switched from one station to another to see if I could hear this song. So this was a very exciting time, but it was also an anomaly because Psy wasn't the typical K-pop artist. He didn't go through a training system. He wasn't in a group like others. And many thought it was a flash in the pan. And it probably was to a certain extent, but it was the first YouTube video that had more than 1 billion views. And I think right now it's at over 4 billion views. So it could have been a flash in the pan, and yes, what is this K-pop? Ah, ha, ha, somebody who's doing a horse dance. But then we come to the year 2013, and we had the debut of a group called BTS, which is actually the letters, the acronym from a Korean word, 방탄소년단, which they have translated to Bulletproof Boy Scouts, but which is, I don't know, such a good translation. But BTS for short, and I think they have now used BTS for other words as well. But the thing about BTS was that it wasn't part of the three major entertainment companies, SM, JYP, or YG. It was from a small company called Big Hits. What is this? Music and Artists for Healing. And so they were known as the Hukseojja. They had the clay spoon and not the golden spoon in their mouths. And so they were in many ways the David to the Goliath of all these other major labels and groups at that time. But what they did very well was they actually started sharing their pre-debut lives. They started sharing what they were practicing, the difficulties that they had, the anticipation for their debut. And so this is true not only for BTS, mostly for BTS, but for a lot of K-pop, is that one of the things that I think the church can learn from K-pop is that it's so accessible. It was very serendipitous that K-pop's rise happened when YouTube came into being in the year 2005. Now, I'd like to thank Stephen Lee and Thomas Kwon, former EM members of Yale Church, who sat me down once at a diner and said, "Chun Yusanim, you should know about this thing called YouTube." And I said, "Oh, okay." And so it was very timely. And I think what K-pop did very well was, from what I hear of different articles and what people have said, is that whereas, let's say, J-pop, Japanese pop music, it was very hard to find their stuff on YouTube, or they didn't really release it as openly as these K-pop bands did. And so K-pop was so accessible that not only folks in Korea, but now people around the world could just click, and then you go into a rabbit hole. So you click some more and click some more and click some more, and now it's like 3 a.m. in the morning, right? So I think accessibility was a big thing. And for BTS, they actually shared, they had a lot of content that they shared. And they had their competitions and sporting events, and K-pop at that time had all the different idol groups have sporting competitions and end of the year performances and a whole ton of content that was coming out, not only from BTS, but also from all these K-pop groups. And I think one of the things I was so excited about that, again, the church could learn from BTS and K-pop is the importance of representation. Growing up as an immigrant, child of immigrants, I wanted to see myself in mainstream America, but I did not. My last name is Kim. I was so excited when I saw another Kim in the Bible, Eliakim. And there was another Kim in the Bible, King Jehoiakim, right? And I was very excited because Zacchaeus was short. And I'm like, ah, I'm short. So when I see myself in the Bible, then I think I will engage with Scripture more. I engage with Scripture because it's not about perfect people, but it's about sinners like me. And when I see that there are people like me, then I could see myself in that particular situation. So for Koreans and Korean Americans, Chan-ho Park, Park Chan-ho was a major figure, a pitcher for LA Dodgers. Park Se-ri, around that same time, was a major figure as well. They have what's called the Se-ri's kids, right? So people started thinking, I too can play golf and play at the major level. I too can play baseball in the major leagues. I have a friend, Pastor Irene Park Lee. I remember thinking, wow, what a wonderful church she grew up in. She was a youth elder in her church at the age of 17 or 18. She represented the youth, which made the youth people think like, hey, I could be a part of the session. Of course, she didn't vote on legal things that adults had to vote on, but she was the voice of her youth group in the session. And so for immigrants who have been given only limited, narrow options for a future career, doctor, lawyer, engineer, It was an opportunity for folks like my students, youth group students, to think like, I could be a singer too. I could be a dancer. I could be an artist. I can be a performer. And so I think seeing them helped me in my need for representation. I was at a national gathering of Korean churches in Seattle in May this year, and I have a friend, Reverend Anne Ree Menzie, and it was so wonderful to see her and a male pastor lead communion, because it meant that other people could see, little girls could see themselves, and they also had three women elders serve communion. And so to be able to see yourself is a powerful teaching tool and a powerful invitation. And so representation is a big part for me as I appreciate K-pop and as I could encourage people to go follow their dreams or their talents, if it be in the world of entertainment or music or the arts. And so accessibility, representation is the big part. If you follow any K-pop group, you will know how hardworking they are, how much they have sacrificed. They have been trainees for a year, sometimes maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years before they could finally debut. They had to practice not only singing, but dancing and learning another language, acting as well. And so I like it when people follow K-pop, so I could tell the young people, see, they're willing to sacrifice and give up and devote themselves to something that they love and are passionate about. Why can't you be able to do that for your passion or for your faith? And so I like to show this video when it comes to a visual aid, if you will, for hard work, sacrifice, discipline, devotion, practice.
And now for my next number, Return to the Classics.
Show this because even their hair goes up and down in sync, I think. The amount of practice and sacrifice that they put into something because they want to debut is just seen in something like this. And so accessibility, representation, hard work, sacrifice. If you go to any K-pop event, there is such a welcome and acceptance. There's a very low bar. You like BTS? I like BTS. Let's be friends. You like K-pop? I like K-pop. And so you started having conversations. So if you go to these K-pop concerts, you will see such a diversity of ages and generations and races and backgrounds and people. And so when they feel welcome, they will take ownership. You don't know how many fans take it upon themselves to translate lyrics, translate dramas, to use their expertise in promotion, or to explain the finances of a particular company because they're a finance major. And so there's a lot of acceptance and welcome that you will experience as a K-pop fan and in the fandom. And so another big thing about K-pop is the fandom. The K-pop artists appreciate the fans and they do not take them for granted. They give them space to participate and show their passion. If you're on YouTube, you'll see a lot of them do cover dances or reaction to a video, or they will review a video or an album, or they will do something called the random dance play. And this is something that happens at different places. I don't know if you've ever seen something like this, but this is at K-Korean. You don't have no idea what's going to come out.
but they know the moves. And they'll do and come together as a group and perform like this. They've never practiced like this together. So 30 seconds, okay? It's called random because another song will come out. If you know it, you go and you dance it. As a pastor, how can I not be envious about such dedication and practice and discipline, right? And so they give the fans a time and space to participate. They are in relationship with them, and they have a mutual give and take kind of relationship. Another thing about fandom is a lot of K-pop groups will have a fan chant, and this is when the fans get an opportunity to participate in the performance. Here is one or two performances for BTS. This is the American Music Awards. In rhythm, they call out the names of the BTS members. Mostly non-Koreans. Different groups have different fan chants, but this one is the leader, and then from the oldest to the youngest. So they interact with the fans. They do not take the fans for granted, and they show respect to the fans. I think when you hear BTS sing in English, because we're English speakers, we don't think of how hard that is. But that's their respect to the English speakers. At a concert, they will struggle with the English, and sometimes you're like, no, just speak Korean, it's okay. We'll have somebody translate. But they have a tremendous respect for their fans. And I think this might show a better way of the respect that they have for their fans. This is EXO, by the way, in Mexico. They're singing a classic in Mexico. I heard from Spanish-speaking fans that their accents are excellent, actually. So can you imagine American artists learn another language song and perform it at that country, as well as they have? And so I think for K-pop fans, they feel seen and they feel heard. They feel seen and they feel heard, which you could see in this example. GD from Big Bang. This was a music video when 1,000 of his fans attended, and they all submitted their videotapes for making this music video. And at the end, you'll see all the names who have contributed to the making of this video. So the fans feel heard and seen. There is a sense of communication that takes place. They used the technology very well, something like VLive, where they talk after big events. For BTS, I think they broke boundaries in many ways by talking about mental health, social issues, youth problems, saying to people, love yourself, and showing honesty and vulnerability. They were the first Korean group to get nominated for a Grammy for their song Dynamite in the year 2021. They kept dangling BTS during Grammys, so I had to like wait until the end to say that they didn't win. So they didn't win, but they came to this live talk with their fans. And this is what they said. They were being honest.
야, 아니, 제가 얘기 안 했어요.
아, 누가 했냐? 내가 했나?
재욱이 했나?
누가 했어? 야, 이거 하면 상 받는다, 이거.
제가
상 받는다. 상 받는다, 이게 개 쓰러져.
물통 생기시. 단 한 번도 쓰질 않더라.
아, 뭐, 이거는 그냥.
불멍 없어요. 네.
뭐, 제가 사실 제일 아쉬운 거 우리 또 팬 여러분들이 또 되게 아쉬울 거예요.
그렇죠. 네. 네. 여러분이 걱정이죠. 뭐.
그렇죠.
So they should be the one who should get you know, supported, but they're trying to support that. No big deal. They were sad though, as was all their fans. So I think they showed a lot of honesty, they showed a lot of vulnerability. They could have not done this V Live, but it was hurtful, but they were sharing that hurt with their fans, and actually they were trying to comfort the fans for not having won the Grammy, being the first one. And so I appreciate BTS because they're so vulnerable, and as you know, they're not working as a group right now. They are at a hiatus. But I commend them because they knew when they needed to rest. I think there are a lot of pastors who should rest, get a Sabbath, get a sabbatical, but they don't. And so I commend them for not performing as a group at this time because they're doing self-care and they are growing their own sense of identity as well as doing their own albums at this particular time. And so when it comes to K-pop, when it comes to BTS, in many ways, it tells me how one can build a community. How one can build a community. It's interesting that all the different groups have a community that is labeled for their concerts as well as their album. SM Entertainment has SM Town. JYP has JYP Nation. YG has YG Family. Some, I don't know HIVE, but some people say, hey, it looks like HIVE, you know, HIVE, maybe all these groups coming together. It could be in the interpretation or whatnot, but beyond just even the title or the names, I see how community can happen, how fans are invited to have a sense of belonging, to want to connect, and believe it or not, they want to meet in person. Isn't that great for a post-pandemic church age? So that there, I think many different things that we could take away from K-pop, aside from enjoying good quality music, but also to kind of think about what the church can be and do better. For me, trying to make sense of K-pop and what it could tell the church and ministries and ministers is a work in progress. So I think I will add to it as I get more opportunities to talk about it. But I think there are many things that we as a church can learn, again, to be as welcoming and accepting, to make sure that different groups are represented, especially in the decision making when it comes to youth groups and English ministries and young adults, to be frank about, hey, you know, there's a lot of hard work and sacrifice and devotion involved in this narrow road called a faith journey. To create space for participation and relationships and honesty and vulnerability, for excellence as well as transparency, to let people know that they are seen and that they are heard and that they are respected, to create a sense of belonging in a community that shares a passion and love for the same God, for the same entity, for the same creator. So there are many people who say that church is in a decline. What are we going to do? And maybe to a certain extent it might be, but I hope that we can still have hope, as this song says. This is their last song as a group before they went on hiatus. Was it honestly the best? Because I just want to see the best. Because it only changed. I just didn't so care. So I know online there are a lot of my former students, and some of them are active at church, some of them are not active at church, some of them do not go to church. But I like to challenge not only them, but every one of us, that, yeah, you know, the church can do better, and we could look back and become, in Korean, what's called a latte people. Back in my day, church was so much better. But I think we could have hope, saying the best is yet to come. And I would like to challenge the different folks in whatever areas you might be in your respective churches, that we should become the church that you want to be a part of. To be a church that creates space for folks to be seen and heard and respected, to communicate, to have honesty and vulnerability, to create community with a sense of passion and delight and enjoyment, because what? We were created to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. And so I hope that the church can be a place and space for all of us to be able to do that and to have the hope that the best is yet to come. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Dialogues podcast. The Center for Asian American Christianity invites you to join our ongoing conversation on Asian American identity, faith, theology, and ministry through the Dialogues magazine, the Dialogues in Asian American Theology and Ministry Public Gatherings, the annual Mental Health Conference, and the annual Asian American Theology Conference. You can find more information and sign up for our newsletter at caac.ptsem.edu.